from Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana. Hi, I'm Tom Schultz, host program. Thanks for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe and please contact me here for show suggestions or comments at tom@voicesofmontana.com. I was alerted. I did a casual search the other day and it alerted me. I looked for nations in debt, right? Bam! It's all of them. We have debt three times our gross domestic product globally. What does that mean, right? I mean, there's some things we have to consider in this. Look at Japan. They're 250% in debt of their GDP. And they have been for years. Perpetual debt trap is what they're in. That was okay for a couple of decades. Now interest rates are rising. China, they're both a debtor nation and a creditor nation. They're employing what some economists and others fear is a debt trap diplomacy with their Belt and Road Initiative countries. And more to come there, too, as well. We'll look at our domestic economy, too, but a glance around the globe today with Dr. Robert, we know him as Tino Sonora, Professor of Finance, University of Montana, Global Debt, China's Leverage, Japan's Debt Crisis, and the Direction of the U.S. Economy, today on Voices of Montana. First off, how you been, sir? It's been a little while.
It's been a little while. A lot of changes since the last time we talked. Good to talk to you as well, Tom. We finally got some snow here in Missoula, so it looks like winter may have arrived finally. So we'll see what happens.
And Ohio State is the number one team in the country, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, that goes without saying, of course. That's, you know, for those of us that went to Ohio State, you know, it's always fun to enjoy their success.
It is, yeah.
Unfortunately for us here in Missoula, UM lost to MSU last weekend, but...
Yeah, good. They let it hurt a little bit, you know.
It's supposed to hurt
a little.
Have a little sting every now and then,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. University of Essex as well, international economies. You've been around the world, okay? And so I really appreciate you weighing in on this. What's your first thought when, you know, a guy like me pops open and gets alerted to all these debtor nations and our global GDP, where, you know, as a planet, we're, I don't know how to put it, we are three times in debt of our gross domestic product. I mean, for me, that signals trouble.
Well, yeah, it depends on which country. And of course, you know, this is, you know, it's always going to be the Truman two-hand economist, right? Because I don't want an economist that says on the one hand, on the other. It's actually funny you should mention that because it reminds me of this paper that was written by Paul Krugman a number of years ago, which kind of basically said that because we have an international trade deficit, we have a trade surplus with Mars or something because we could, you know, there's some money that's falling out. So I guess we have a trade deficit or a budget deficit, global budget deficit with Mars right now. So we're borrowing from Mars. Wow. Yeah, it really depends on the country. And, you know, for countries, we mentioned Japan has been in, has had a huge debt to GDP ratio over 200% for a number of years. And, you know, a lot of people would point to that and say, well, it's going to start causing interest rates rising. It's going to, you know, generate inflation and, you know, kind of put Japan in a bad state. But, you know, some of these things just don't happen. So, for example, in Japan, their interest rates have remained relatively low. Inflation's been relatively low. And in fact, some of that debt was created because they wanted inflation because they were in a deflationary spiral, which is actually worse than having too much inflation in some cases. And so, you know, it really depends on the country. In a country like the United States, where our debt to GDP ratio is, you know, it's big, but it's not crazy, if you will, by some standards, you know, we kind of get a benefit because a lot of people want to buy our debt, and that actually finances our purchases and keeps our interest rates down. And the question then becomes, well, what is the sort of tipping point where too much debt becomes problematic? So a paper that was written by two famous economists, Kenneth Rogoff and his co-author, whose name escapes me right now, Carmen Reinhart, wrote a paper probably about 10 to 15 years ago, which basically said that the sort of tipping point where debt becomes deleterious to the economy is about a 90% debt to GDP ratio. Well, what's kind of interesting about that is, you know, there was a graduate student at the University of Massachusetts that tried to do the math and realized there was a bunch of coding errors in that paper, and that actually they were wrong. And then consequently, a couple co-authors and I wrote a paper a number of years ago basically try to estimate what that threshold was. And we found that that threshold could be anywhere from like 30% debt to GDP ratio to like 100-200% debt to GDP ratio. So there really was no identifiable sort of tipping point where it actually can be problematic. A country like the United States, where the dollar is basically the global currency, we kind of get the benefit of that, and that people are willing to buy our debt still. And so we don't have that sort of, I don't think, that potential where we're going to sort of enter into a situation where interest rates will start to spike and possibly pushing on us on a path downwards. But, you know, that's just for the foreseeable future, and those things could change. And sort of when you think about another group of economists that come out, because it's called modern monetary theory, and basically yes. they say, why don't we just print money? You know, I mean, the United States can just print money, people will buy it, and we'll just buy stuff. You know, there's no real need to actually worry about the debt, and so who cares what the debt is? And there's been a little, I don't want to say that that's gained a lot of, you know, sort of mainstream traction, but it certainly entered the discussion, and I think that became more prevalent during the financial crisis when the Fed decided to expand the money supply and issue lots of debt. And, of course, the naysayers were saying, oh, interest rates are going to spike, inflation is going to go through the roof because so much cash is floating around in the system. But none of those things came to play or panned out. So, you know, I think we're having a little bit of a belly button gaze period right now because of things, the way things have been going recently and some of the policies that have sort of come down the pike.
What? All right. I'm not sure that none of those things in my mind haven't played out here. I'm taking this simple man approach. You just start printing money and printing money and printing money. You know, real value is based on production, not paper.
Right.
Yeah. So it just doesn't make sense to me. And I know that was made famous by Bernie Sanders and you know, and it buys a lot of votes or it gets a lot of votes. But it doesn't make fiscal sense to just overspend your budget. I mean, aren't we saddling our children? And as you noted, and I find that hilarious. I'll have to look that up. You know, we're going to get all these resources from Mars. So right now we're just we got Mars to bank on here down the road. But that just does not seem like a logical approach to any kind of regular living.
Right. Well, I try to use the analogy. It depends on what you're buying with your debt, right? I mean, would you say that buying a house with debt is a good thing?
Right.
For example.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is why do I make my present self pay for the house that my future self is going to enjoy, and I have to pay 100% of it? You know, same things with, you know, I often use the highway. So the Federal Highway Administration, Federal Highway Act of 1956 basically created a freeway system. And the United States government issued debt to create freeways. Well, I still enjoy those freeways that were constructed in 1962. And is it reasonable for me to expect the 1962 American to pay 100% of the bill of something that I still enjoy? If you look at your own household finances, you know, I can look at my sort of my debt to GDP ratio, which would be sort of my mortgage debt divided by my annual income, you know, is probably close to 200-300%. Is that a bad thing? Well, probably not. It just depends on what you buy. Now, if I have a debt to GDP ratio or a you know, debt credit card debt to income ratio of 300%, and all I'm doing is flying off to Australia and having fun, then that's bad debt. But good debt is when you invest in the economy, and that's something that is worth looking into, and it's not necessarily construed as this is a bad thing per se. Now, we do have problems, I guess one of the big concerns I have now is with things like some of the Social Security. We have an aging population. Mm-hmm. The younger population is not sort of filling those gaps. And I think, you know, we're going to start running into those kinds of issues more. I think that's a little bit more pressing than our national debt, if you will, because certainly our national debt is being used to pay off previous debt. We're increasing debt to purchase things. And it just remains to be seen where that actually plays out. And certainly a lot of our debt was accumulated during very big crises.
Right.
And during the financial crisis, you know, there were those economists that argued and that the fact, the amount of debt that the United States went into was probably not going to be enough. And so that was actually talked down by other economists because they just didn't think, you know, these guys just politically didn't think that the United States citizens were ready for that kind of level of debt. However, you know, we sort of have a counterpart to our we did increase our debt pretty precipitously and pulled ourselves out of the financial crisis relatively quickly. I know at the time it seems pretty slow, but, you know, historically it was relatively fast, especially given the depth of that recession, the Great Recession. But if you look at towards like Europe, for example, they kind of followed the opposite tact, and they increased their taxes and reduced their government expenditures. And most European countries are still basically recovering from that financial crisis. I know Italy, for example, maybe last year, caught up with where they were in 2007. Germany has not grown in 5 or 6 years. I mean, there's zero economic growth. And so there is something to be said of how you kind of conduct this. And obviously there's other kinds of structural differences between the United States and most of the rest of the world, most European countries in particular. But suffice to say, one could argue that part of the reason that they have not recovered yet is because they're basically employing what is referred to as austerity programs, where you increase taxes and reduce government spending in order to keep your debt down, interest rates down, minimize inflation, et cetera, et cetera.
So you're talking about the 2008
correct
recession, yep. Right? Yeah, I found that interesting as well, because you're right. We recovered a lot quickly, and noted economists said maybe we didn't do enough during the pandemic. There was a lot of money applied, and I've had conversations with others about it, and we had a big economy to protect in that regard as well. It was merited in my mind. But now we're running deficits. I mean, on an annual basis. And we look at Japan, and they're in, like you said, part of it was caused deliberately because of inflationary pressures, but and their debt is mostly domestically owned, which I think is a
correct.
Big factor here too, where they can sustain perpetual debt, so to speak. But with interest rates rising, and you noted they're having demographic problems as well. So there's concern. Now it's harder to attract investment. And I'm worried about a domino effect here.
Well, I mean, that's the big thing. You know, the joke is when the United States sneezes, the world catches a cold. And that's something that we really want to kind of keep an eye on. I think there's other structural policy issues that are probably a bigger threat right now than the debt. I think the debt will be exacerbated by our current policies. And so if you're worried about debt, then I think we're kind of doing the wrong thing, if you will, right now.
I just think it's irresponsible.
Certainly.
I'm going to take a break here because you keyed on something that I want to hit when we come on back, those structural policy issues. I'd like to find out what a few more of those are, and then we'll talk about this perpetual debt trap. And one thing to get on the plate, too, is what folks are now considering possible debt trap diplomacy by China out there as well. Our guest today is Dr. Robert Tino Sonora, professor of finance, University of Montana. We're back with more Voices in a bit. Perpetual debt trap. It's a new term on me, but I get that. I think that's where Japan is a little bit right now. I'm looking at China, and, you know, they've had this Belt and Road Initiative. Welcome back to From Montana, For Montana, Voices of Montana. They have been investing across Southeast Asia, also Latin America and Africa as well. There's been some reports of repayment stress, high interest rates, aggressive repayment terms, where critics have said now Beijing is hoping to, gain these strategic assets through this debt trap diplomacy. There are some things on our plate here today. And Dr. Robert Tino Sonora joins us here, University of Montana, professor there of finance, and also well-written, a two-time Fulbright recipient, as I mentioned as well, still co-editor of the Zagreb International Review and of Economics and Business. So knows a little bit about international politics and economies. Thanks, Tino, for being here. You're a bike rider as well. That's probably more fun than anything you get to talk about, right?
It is. And now, And now that we got snow, I'm looking forward to skiing as well. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's probably late for you then, isn't it? Where's that snow?
Almost right on cue, right? Thanksgiving. So.
Okay, beautiful. So right. We talked a bit about some structural policy issues here. So debt, currently, like you said, you know, it depends on what you buy with debt. There's some good things there. Demographics are changing that a little bit. The interest rate is changing that a little bit. If we might not be able to invest in our economy or invest in infrastructure, that's some of the worries. And we've seen that play out in other countries. And then that opens an avenue for China to get in there as well. And they're not friendly with their monetary policy when it comes to almost any country. Give us an idea, structural policy issues that can address this in a, you know, kind of a front-on sort of way.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to yeah. I don't even know where to start on this, this question. I mean, let's just briefly, the Belt and Road Initiative was started by China about, 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. Basically investing in infrastructure to help promote some of its exports. So it's invested heavily, as you mentioned, in infrastructure in Africa, Eastern Europe as well, and Western Europe. And so some of it's been in infrastructure, some of it's been in transportation, I think, is a big one. Energy's has been one. And certainly China has signed contracts with some African, I don't remember the exact specifics, but Sudan comes to mind, with Sudan for sort of basically right to their oil, in exchange for some infrastructure investment, energy investment. Essentially what they're doing is, some people kind of think of it as the Silk Road, and it's a way to, a modern Silk Road to help Chinese exports flow into Western Europe in particular. And they've been investing in Eastern Europe as well, and I think part of that has to do with sort of a little bit laxer regulations and sort of viewing it as not necessarily a final destination for Chinese exports, but more as sort of a conduit for Chinese exports into Western Europe. And despite all that, their investment in Eastern Europe is a little bit lower than it has been in Western Europe, but that's just in dollar figures, and things are a little bit cheaper, obviously, in Eastern Europe than Western Europe, so it could just reflect that. I've actually wrote a paper on some of this stuff, so I have a little bit of I know a little bit about it.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, in terms of, I had a brilliant thing I was going to say. I know what to say. So, China's followed what is known as an export-led model of growth, and they've tried to basically follow what the Japanese, was sort of a Japanese model that kind of got exported to Korea and a lot of Southeast Asia, where you basically import intermediate goods and minerals and things like that, and then export them to add some value to the exports and really sort of try to export your way to growth. And the Chinese miracle too over the past, up until a few years ago, was sort of heavily financed by government expenditures, as you mentioned, and government investment. And so, we heard stories of Chinese growth being, 7 to 12% per year annual growth rates in their economy. And a lot of that was financed by government expenditures and government investment, housing, and these kinds of things. And what China's been doing over the past, 5 years or so is actually try to realign their portfolio, if you will, of what they're trying to, what they want, where they want the growth to actually come from. And they are moving away from sort of a export and heavily financed by the government infrastructure towards household consumption, more like the United States, more closely aligned with the United States. And then here we have about 70% of our GDP is final household consumption. Now, we can debate whether that's too high or too low, but that's basically where the United States has been for quite some time. Yeah. Somewhere between 70% of GDP is household consumption. And China's trying to realign itself that way. One could probably argue that they've overly invested in some of their housing in particular, some of their infrastructure projects, as they try to sort of realign their economy more towards internal consumption rather than export-led growth. But the Belt Road Initiative is one way that they've tried to gain access to intermediate goods, minerals, and these kinds of things for their production – and as I said, also to sort of help reduce the cost of exporting their stuff to Western Europe, as I said, in particular.
Yeah, and there's the temptation there, and I think it's real as well in terms of what Beijing gains in these strategic assets, collateralized items, you know, like oil and critical minerals and things like that. And they're out there competing at a real high level as well. Notes of some aggressive, repayment terms. But that's, these countries they need this kind of infrastructure investment as well, but they're vulnerable too. And so it creates, let's talk about Japan's debt a little bit in note that it's mostly domestically owned. And I've got, thanks, Cody, 3 minutes here. That does make a huge difference. And America's debt is largely domestically owned too.
It's largely domestically owned and it's largely held by the Fed and mm-hmm. other government institutions. And another thing that we sort of forget about when we talk about debt is that, one man's debt is another man's income. Mm. And so, when you have a mortgage, you're in debt to the bank, but the bank uses that income. It's income for the bank. And if I own debt, I get income from that debt, and that helps increase my own spending and my overall income. And so, there's two sides to the same coin, and people sort of tend to sort of highlight, how bad the debt is, and, every American owes, $4 million in debt or whatever. I just made that up. But, also there's a lot of people that do generate income from that. And again, depending on what that debt is being used for, it could be very helpful. I remember a paper I saw years ago where they try to estimate what the returns to the federal highway system is to the United States economy. And the rate of return on the federal highway system, in terms of transportation, trucking, et cetera, was something like on the order of 15% to 20%. So really high rate of return on that highway. If you think about like a big semi bouncing along some dirt road, versus what it can actually do, despite the fact that we do have some deficits, if you will, in our infrastructure, it still does provide a fairly robust rate of return. And so we're all benefiting from the fact that they started building highways and freeways, I should say, in 1956. And so again, why make 1956 Americans pay for 2025 benefits all at once? And so, we issue debt, and that's a way of financing things. Just like, as I said, we finance education. That's a good thing. We finance our house. It's a good thing.
China, Japan, global debt, our debt. What's driving the world economy? Pleasure to have you back here. Voices of Montana. As Bernadette said, from Montana for Montana. Pleasure to have Dr. Robert Tino Sonora here, University of Montana professor of finance there, and has been a longtime friend of the program, internationally known as well, and published, and just a lot of things here to talk about. Tino, I want to get back into spending here too, but I'm gonna throw the bomb of all questions on you people are worried. I think we're concerned about a financial collapse and what would happen in this kind of, international community. People are nervous about digital currency. People are nervous about one world currency. And all these things seem to me to kind of, they add pressure to those possibilities. I want to drop that on you at some point here, too. And I know that's a tough one, but let's go back to spending. We have been running annual deficits. I question what we're spending on. One of the things that a couple of times you said, it depends on what you buy with your debt. And I don't know that I feel like we're buying appropriately with our children's money.
That gets in the weeds of what's in an individual budget, or is it infrastructure reconstruction? Is it new investment? Is it, you could think about, is it some help with some R&D expenditures?
A lot of social spending.
That's what I was just going to say. Our transfer payments is actually a larger percentage of our total government debt than is actual consumption expenditures. So debt, government spends money on just transfer payments. That'll be all your unemployment insurance, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid kind of stuff. And then you have consumption expenditures, which is basically real government consumption, which is purchases of goods and services, so cars and highways and fire trucks, et cetera. So our transfer payments are actually bigger by roughly $1.5 trillion. By roughly $500 billion. So we spend a lot on that transfer payments. And that's, I think, you know, the obvious worry about the sort of demographic shift is that if the younger generation can't work because of a riot, for whatever reason, you know, we're seeing unemployment among youth, recent college graduates starting to rise for the first time, pick up a little bit. And as the sort of older generations start to grow relative to the rest of the size of the population, you know, mm-hmm. how do we finance some of these transfer payments? As I mentioned before, we're, I don't know, well, maybe when we were talking offline, but I mentioned something about a K-shaped economy, which is sort of the new sort of term that people are throwing around these days, which is, you know, lower income and individuals are going to start going into decline in terms of wealth and income, and now richer individuals will get richer still, so they get a K-shaped
shrinking economy. Shrinking of the middle class, then.
And the shrinking of the middle class, yeah. You know, and what does it mean to be middle class anymore? You know, is it $150,000? You know, that's pretty substantial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it depends on people's expenditures and their spending patterns, but suffice to say that, you know, transfer payments is a very, very big deal. That's the thing that I think we're most concerned about. And is that a worthwhile expenditure? Well, you know, I would argue that in some cases, yes. I mean, we do need, you know, we need health, for example. We need people been paying into Social Security, so they should theoretically get that back. And again, what we're doing with our expenditures on consumption, of, you know, a lot of it's military expenditure. So about, I don't know, $750 billion a year, to almost maybe a trillion is federal defense expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We're obviously trying to shrink, the current administration is shrinking some of the other things that we spend money on, particularly for abroad. But that represents just, you know, almost chump change in the couch kind of money. But, you know, most of it's expenditures for defense. Obviously, education, you know, all you think of all your departments that we have, all of your cabinet positions, you know, what do they spend money on? FEMA, those kinds of things. But those represent a relatively small fraction. A lot of government expenditure also, you know, if we think about it at the state and local level, is for fire, police, education, all of those kinds of things are also government spending, and a lot of people rely on that. And so that's part of our government expenditures as well.
The concentration of wealth, the concentration of wealth has concerned me just because I feel with AI coming in, if it's fully deployed, so to speak, I think we get more and more a concentration of wealth because, you know, the labor that would fuel our personal economy is going to have to shift in some way. I mean, and that's probably on your plate, too, as an economist.
Oh, absolutely. And we going back to just the wealth thing too, you know, we were talking yesterday, you know, we're looking at the sort of S&P 500, for example, has been sort of on a tear recently, but that's 40% of the stock of that particular stock index is basically the Magnificent Seven,
right? Mm-hmm.
So it's NVIDIA, Google, these kinds of things, more heavily invested in AI. And that is, you're exactly right, fueling concern that we're maybe in an AI bubble. And that could pop, and what effect would that have? Well, that becomes a little bit kind of scary because if that does happen, there's been some estimates of what is known as the wealth effect and what the wealth effect is on spending, and I think it's something like for every dollar of new wealth, households spend 4 more cents. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, you know, 4% increase in spending, but when we're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars, that translates into real money. And then if we also sort of think about that over 50% of consumer expenditures is done by the richest 20%, and those guys have the most wealth, well, if their wealth collapses, that could really, really put a dent in consumer expenditures. And that's where we're seeing people on the lower end really suffering with higher prices, inflation. I think we're going to, you know, that we got to get inflation in check because people are having issues with inflation, clearly. Especially at the lower end. And in fact, I was looking at some data recently and the impact of tariffs has most highly impacted consumer goods that are most likely to be purchased by people at the lower end of the income spectrum. Whereas other goods, which are at the higher end of the spectrum, have been least affected by tariffs. And so it is real pain, and which is why we're seeing some of these kind of consumer sentiment indices, you know, the University of Michigan has a pretty well-known consumer sentiment index, and it's almost the lowest it's been. It's at the lowest point almost ever. The lowest point was during COVID, and during the really in the aftermath of COVID, and the very very high inflationary situation that we had in say 2022. So we're consumer sentiment is not good, and inflation expectations at the consumer level remain at about 4 or 5%. So people are still anticipating higher rates of inflation, and that's a concern.
And, you know, we've got like about 5 minutes left or so, and I want to start this discussion. Now, there's a lot to cover, and I really appreciate you coming on here. Because there's a ton of places to go. Tariffs I wanted to put on the plate here. But I got to ask again the simple man question about where does this all lead? And there are, you know, you look at, well, you noted them. We've had the Great Depression, you know, the Great Recession, Latin America debt crisis. There was some bank failures in the 30s that led to that. A lot of factors alert people to some potential collapse. And I hate that word, but, you know, we've dealt with that. Those things are kind of lining up in a little way here, too. What do you feel is the concern for that? What do you feel could happen next? What do you feel, you know, as you talk both nationally and internationally, what can economists, you know, what do we do right now to avoid that?
Yeah, Tom, if I had the answer to that question, I'd be making multi-millions of dollars.
You'd be getting paid for this interview in New York. Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And it would not be cheap. Right?
Yeah, right. So, yeah.
Right now, my concern is that lower income households are going to be facing a recession. It's not necessarily going to show up in the aggregate figures, because obviously when you look at things in aggregate, it masks the highs and it masks the lows. So my concern is that we're potentially seeing lower income families moving into recession. And then the higher income individuals are going to be sort of oblivious to that because they're going to be doing fine. Oh, the policy uncertainty the way it is, I don't know, because we've got a case in front of the Supreme Court now, where, you know, the tariffs have been challenged. Tariffs could be gone tomorrow. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, we have so much uncertainty, and I think that's really playing into the economy because we just really don't know where we're headed. And businesses can't make plans because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know what interest rates are going to do tomorrow. We don't know if AI bubble is going to pan out or AI is going to pan out or not. I just read a report from JP Morgan saying that, you know, AI is going to be driving the economy. Could see, I can't remember what index hit 8,000, but, you know, I think it was the S&P. So, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty. What's kind of been hard for me to understand is we just don't see it in some of the financial data. We don't see bond yields rising, which is usually what you might see happening when there's more uncertainty. But on the other hand, it could be that, and I don't understand why bond yields are actually falling and stock prices are rising. That there's not this sort of relationship right between bond prices and stock prices. It's very tricky, and interest rates are the same. It's a very, very hard to sort of pull any kind of information from what's going on.
Oh, and I remember
looking at things.
I remember you talking about that earlier too. And I find that as well. You know, we feel underneath that we're uneasy about all this, but those financial indicators are not leaning in that direction. But then again, they've been hard to read. And I guess maybe that's the good news, is that with all of this uncertainty as well, we're still holding it together. We need to get headed in a better direction, though, in my mind.
Right. And things, you know, I'm just looking at bond yields right now. And when you have interest rates on 3 month and 10-year basically being the same, and we had an inverted yield curve for, what, 3 years?
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of unprecedented, which is why I think I started at the very beginning saying, you know, we're having a little bit of a staring at our belly button moment as we try to parse through some of this information and trying to make sense of it all.
Well, we need the data, though. I mean, hopefully we have an understanding because I think we're at that time, you know, where we kind of have to figure this out.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah. I, you know, that's, you know, my word of year is uncertainty. And, you know, I kind of joke that I, when people ask me what's going to happen, I don't think I've said I don't know so many times in my life as I have in the past, you know, since January. So, it's been hard, and that's even going through the, you know, financial crisis where I, you know, most of what people anticipated would happen did happen. Maybe more than they had thought, and certainly more than I had thought. But it kind of played out according to a playbook, and right now we're kind of on in uncharted territory, yeah. I think. And I mean, that's I guess my biggest concern right now is, as I said, is that the K-shaped economy.
Yeah, yeah, I appreciate that, and you know, and that's part of it that we're concerned too. And I know we're out of time, but it seems like there's a playbook out here that nobody sent me, and I don't think I'm written into it.
We all feel lost, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so I've got concerns about this agenda. Hey, Tino, thanks, man. What are you doing for Thanksgiving?
I'm going to Denver for a couple days, so hopefully all the flight stuff sorted out and the snow won't affect things. But how about yourself?
Oh, we're gonna you know, hole up a little bit and be nice. Thankful. Be thankful for that too.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Nice.
Good chatting with you, Robert.
Likewise, Tom.
Look forward to let's do it again soon, okay? And as soon as you find, if you have any one answer, even if you get one answer, call me, okay?
Okay, I'll do that.
All right. Appreciate that. Thanks, Robert. Thanks again for joining us for the podcast. And join us daily Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana, a live issue-oriented talk show heard daily on local stations all across Montana.